He has sold more than 128 million recordings. He was one of the top touring acts for years. But back in 2000, Garth Brooks announced that he was retiring to raise his three daughters. And while he's done a few shows and released some material since then, Brooks has kept a pretty low profile until tonight. Garth Brooks is back, out of retirement and playing Las Vegas, where he's starting a long series of shows. NPR's Ted Robbins tells us about the deal that got him back on stage.
Yeah, she's my lady luck, hey, I'm her wild card man. Together we're building up a real hot pan.
What song do you play to open a story about Garth Brooks coming to Las Vegas? Well, two of a kind works, Lady Luck, Wild Card, and the title. Yeah, it refers to lovers, but in this case, we'll bend it a bit to make it business partners. Garth Brooks and Steve Wynn, who owns the Encore Hotel, where Brooks is playing. The two men sat on stage a couple of months ago to announce a five-year deal.
When Steve Wynn approached me about playing, he did something different than anybody else had.
During the week, Garth Brooks stays home in Oklahoma with his family. On the weekend, he flies to Vegas for four shows.
My life is not going to change for the next 5 years, except I'm going to get to play music, and I'm excited.
And what did it cost to make it happen? Neither Brooks nor Wynn will tell. But if this is any indication, Steve Wynn says he needed to arrange some custom transportation.
I will confess I had to buy him a jet plane.
Garth Brooks hasn't exactly been a recluse since his official retirement in 2001. 2 years ago, he did some shows in Kansas City and L.A. Then this year, he played at President Obama's inauguration. But this is a performer who built his name in the 90s by touring and selling out big arenas. So a regular gig is a return to old ways, though longtime country music writer Robert Orman says he never doubted it would happen. Brooks loves performing too much, says Orman, and the long Las Vegas commitment is a chance to make performing history.
I mean, other artists have done it, like Cher and Bette Midler and Elton John and different people, but this would be a first for a country artist to go into a Vegas casino for an extended run like this.
The Encore Theater is not an arena. It seats 1,500, not 15,000. Tickets are $125 apiece. Moderate for Vegas, but higher than Brooks has ever charged. When the tickets went on sale, Tammy Guadagnoli used a couple of computers and a couple of phone lines, then waited for an hour and a half.
Yeah, I got the golden ticket.
Two tickets, actually, for the first show tonight. She left her husband and kids at home in Pittsburgh for a couple of days and met a girlfriend in Vegas. Now, Tammy Guadagnoli is not a casual Garth Brooks fan. She's seen him perform live 18 times.
But there's just something about him when he gets in a room with his fans and everybody's singing and everybody behind him, and there's just this feeling that you just can't put your finger on it that you only get when you see him.
Garth Brooks is sold out this weekend and for every show that's been offered so far. Ted Robbins, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. George Walker is a trailblazer among African-American composers. He's had more than 80 commissions, and in 1996, he won a Pulitzer Prize. Now the 87-year-old has done something he's never done before. He's written a work for his son, a violinist. Gregory Walker is premiering his father's violin concerto this week with the Philadelphia Orchestra. And Joel Rose has the story.
Gregory Walker didn't know his father was writing a violin concerto for him until the finished score showed up in the mail.
Didn't know about it until it was too late. He maintained the element of surprise. And I think, along with that, an element of artistic control, and he's an expert at that.
Something that George Walker doesn't entirely deny, but the composer says he knew his son was up to the task.
It's not a long work, but it's a very intense and difficult and challenging work for both the soloist and the orchestra.
Thank you. George Walker has been writing intense, sometimes difficult music for more than 50 years. Walker was born in Washington, D.C. He was the first black pianist to give a recital at New York's Town Hall in 1945. Walker studied composition with two of the best, Nadia Boulanger in Paris and Rosario Scalero at the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. But success as a composer did not come easily.
I had to find my own way, a way of doing something that was different, something that I would be satisfied with.
Walker's patience was rewarded in 1996 when he became the first black composer to win the Pulitzer Prize for Music for the piece Lilacs. Even Gregory Walker admits it took him a while to understand his father's music.
I just was weaned with his particular approach to the art from a time when I didn't understand what he was going for, when it was just as abstract to me as it can be for other lay listeners. But in time, with different kinds of exposure, I've really learned to embrace and hopefully communicate what he has in mind.
Gregory Walker has made a specialty out of playing his father's compositions. This is a recording they made together of his Sonata No. 1 for violin and piano. Gregory Walker is also the concertmaster of the Boulder Philharmonic Orchestra in Colorado. When George Walker sat down to write his new violin concerto, he knew he wanted his son to give the world premiere.
I wanted him to have the opportunity of performing a work on a larger scale for a larger audience than he had ever done before. I had hope that I could persuade at least one orchestra to allow him to play it.
It almost didn't happen. The Philadelphia Orchestra was in talks to perform the concerto at Carnegie Hall earlier this year with a different violinist. George Walker said no, but his son Gregory admits he's not the kind of superstar soloist whose name alone can sell tickets.
We know that there are other people who, if they set their minds to it, can play this music, and that's one of my main aspirations, that I can at least hold the torch long enough without singeing myself to pass it on to a great player who can make a vehicle of it and really deliver it to the wider audience it deserves.
I'd like to correct that. The fact is that in insisting that he play the concerto, I was aware that he could do justice to the work. Don't for a minute think that there's anybody who's going to play it better than he. Don't for a minute think that.
What George and Gregory Walker both hope is that their collaboration will bring attention to one piece and two careers that deserve more of it. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
You can listen to part of that violin concerto from its Philadelphia premiere at nprmusic.org. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This past decade has featured dramatic changes in the ways we listen to and make music. One major transformation is how we record music. Recording technology has become much more affordable, so bands no longer need to book hours of costly studio time in a facility with millions of dollars of equipment. They can simply record on a laptop. So, where does that leave professional recording studios? Joel Rose has that story.
New York City used to be home to dozens of high-end recording studios, none more famous than the aptly named Hit Factory.
The Mississippi Delta was shining like a national guitar. Batman sitting on a little stool takes money from my hand while his eyes take a walk all over you.
They say the sky's the limit, and to me the
I'm standing outside the Hit Factory on West 54th Street in Manhattan. In the lobby of the building, you can still see platinum records by Paul Simon, Bruce Springsteen, and Michael Jackson. But the building is no longer a recording studio. It's condos, starting at just over $1 million each.
This whole area in New York City was filled with recording studios that were busy all the time.
Jim Anderson is a longtime recording engineer and NPR alum who now teaches at New York University.
I could start counting off, I don't know how many recording studios that were within a 10-block area. Media Recording, Hit Factory, Sony Studios, A&R Recording.
Anderson says digital technology has gotten a lot better over the last 10 years to the point where you can make an almost professional quality recording on your laptop for a fraction of what you'd spend in professional studios.
They lost a lot of work that was coming in maybe on demos or on spec. All of that little work just drifted away.
All that little work can now be done in a home studio. If that was the only problem, larger studios might have been able to get by. But some of the big work dried up, too, as the major record labels slashed their budgets. Add the soaring price of real estate, and it's easy to see why most of the well-known Manhattan studios closed their doors. But there are still a few in business.
Yeah, I love it. That cajon sounds great.
Gabriel Alegria and his Afro-Peruvian sextet are mixing an album around the block from the old Hit Factory at Avatar Studios. It's one of the last recording facilities in town big enough to accommodate a full orchestra. General manager Tino Passante insists Avatar offers something you just can't get from a computer in your bedroom.
You can never replicate the sound of a room unless you have a room. And you can hear it missing in records that are not done in the studio. I mean, yeah, you can make a record at home, but that doesn't mean you should.
It's not just big New York studios that are feeling squeezed. Even in Philadelphia, where the rent is a lot cheaper, the past decade has been a struggle for many studios.
So I've been sort of pecking away at this a little bit, just the instrumental track so far.
Engineer Brian McTeer runs Minor Street Recordings. He's been working with indie rock bands in Philadelphia since the 1990s, and business was good until the credit crunch of 2008.
All of a sudden, we were stuck. I had nobody that could pay me anymore. And everyone wanted to pay me. Everyone wanted to make these records. I just had to go the extra distance of helping them figure out where they would get money from.
Sometimes that meant showing bands how to appeal directly to their fans online to raise money for the recording. Then, earlier this year, McTeer launched the Weather Vane Music Organization. It's a nonprofit that helps artists record one song in his studio for free, while Weather Vane documents the project on video.
Hey, guys. A little slow.
This is from one of four sessions so far by the Philadelphia band BC Camplight. Frontman Brian Cristinzio says it would be cheaper to record at home, but that's not the sound he's going for.
I refuse to make a record that I know could be better. I mean, it just doesn't make sense. It's like, why would I do something that I know could be better if I just had the money? So that's where I am now, and probably where I'll be when I'm 70.
Cristinzio has made two records, and he's ready to start his third, but he says his label can't afford to pay for it. Engineer Brian McTeer hopes to help musicians in Cristinzio's situation through his Weather Vane organization, and that it'll attract enough attention to become economically self-sustaining. It has projects planned next year with 10 artists, including singer and songwriter Sufjan Stevens. McTeer hopes musicians see the value of studios like his.
The real value for most bands isn't the equipment. I mean, a guy at Guitar Center or Sam Ash would like you to think that if you just spend $3,000, you're on your way to making your record because you bought the equipment. This sort of unseen, disappearing player in all the records being made today is collaboration between artists and engineers and producers and studio musicians and all those people.
People who probably won't fit in your bedroom anyway. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
And you can find all of our coverage of music in the past decade at nprmusic.org. More than 500 years ago, Leonardo da Vinci invented a musical instrument. He invented it, but it was probably never heard by the public until today. industrial designers from Italy have reconstructed a harpsichord viola from sketches in Da Vinci's notebooks. And as NPR's Robert Smith reports, you could hear it played today in New York City.
Fans of Renaissance music made their way this morning to the Discovery Center in Times Square. The Pifro Ensemble warmed up the crowd as the spectators peered into this strange-looking musical box on a pedestal. No one in the audience had yet heard it, except for Krista Patton. She'll be playing the harp alongside Leonardo's harpsichord viola.
I think the sound of the viola is very revealing because it's very sweet, and it makes me think that that was the sound he had in his ears, possibly.
The harpsichord viola is about the size of a child's toy piano. It weighs 33 pounds and straps to the player's chest. It's unlike anything else in the orchestra. It has the strings of a violin, but it's played with a keyboard, and it's powered by the player's legs as he walks. Before the first performance, I found the designers trying to tune the thing, which isn't easy because it's built with the materials that Leonardo would have had on hand, wooden pegs and gears run by twine. Eduardo Zanin and Massimiliano Lisa are with the firm Leonardo III, which has designed a traveling exhibit of Da Vinci's inventions. They showed me the fragment from the Codex Atlanticus, where a tiny sketch of a musical instrument was found.
The thing that made it very difficult to make this interpretation and probably prevented other scholars to do it till now is that the left part of the page is missing forever, probably.
In the fragment that remains, you can see that the instrument had a harness. So the designers figured it was invented as a way to play a stringed instrument while marching.
For sure during parades or ceremonies or things like that.
The leg pumps a wooden motor, which moves a long loop of horsehair through the instrument. When the player presses the keys, the strings move up against the loop. Eduardo Zanin has been working on the recreation for 5 years and just finished.
We heard it playing for the first time just last week.
It was then that he discovered the problem. What they couldn't have known from the design in Leonardo's notebook was that the motor in the machine made a huge racket.
So it's just the limitation of the technology of the time.
So this may explain why we haven't played this for 500 years.
Yeah.
Nobody solved it yet.
Of course. The problem was the technology of the engine, and that's why probably this instrument was not produced and used after Leonardo.
When the time came for the premiere, the designers warned the crowd about the noise problem, and then Eduardo Zanin began to play. Krista Patton played along on harp.
After a while, I find that I don't hear all the noise of the mechanism, and I'm satisfied with the sweet sound of the viola in it.
Consider percussion.
Like the sound of the inventor's mind working while the music is going on.
The designers with Leonardo III would eventually like to replace the wooden engine with something a little quieter. Not as authentic, yes, but perhaps a little closer to what Da Vinci was trying to hear. Robert Smith, NPR News, New York.